Hi, friends. Welcome to the Get Off Your Affirmation podcast. I'm Leona Evans, and I'm here today, as always, with my son and co-host, Matthew J. Evans.
Hi, thanks for listening. Welcome to part two of our interview with Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. He's an author, speaker, and one of the foremost proponents for nonviolence in our world today. His books include The Forgotten Woman, The Untold Story of Kastur, the Wife of Mahatma Gandhi, Legacy of Love, My Education in the Path of Nonviolence, The Gift of Anger, and the two Grandfather Gandhi books, Teaching Children About the Ways of Nonviolence. Arun is a wise and fascinating guest. He's also a dear friend, and he was the subject of a documentary short film I produced called A Quest for Peace, Nonviolence Among Religions. If you haven't listened to part one of this interview, please check it out. Now, let's continue the conversation.
Before we started taping, we were talking about a very, very important individual in the history of the civil rights movement that taught courses in nonviolence based on your grandfather's teachings. Do you want to talk about him for a moment or two?
Yes, it was the Reverend James Lawson. He was a United Methodist priest. And during his young days, when he got into priesthood, he was sent to India to head a church there, Methodist Church. And it happened to be in a town very close to where Gandhi's ashram was established. And so he came in very close touch with Gandhiism and studied the philosophy there and met with people who had worked with grandfather and learned from them. And when he came to the United States and the Montgomery bus boycott took place and he saw the potential for a nonviolent action, he began to train these young people. So you see those protests that took place in Nashville. He was based in Nashville, teaching there when he came back from India. But the protests that took place in the cafeterias in Nashville, where the people sat at the Woolworth counters and asked for service, and if they didn't get it, they quietly sat there in spite of the fact that the whites did all kinds of things to them. They not only threw food at them and drinks at them, but they lighted cigarettes were extinguished on their bodies and tortured in many ways. But they sat quietly without raising a voice or raising their arms and suffered the consequences. Now, that is what true nonviolence is, where you suffer, but you don't show any hate and prejudice. The moment you react to the prejudices that people throw at you, then you are not being nonviolent. Then you are seeking revenge. The purpose of justice is not to do harm, but to heal.
Yes.
What we are doing in the name of justice today is we are harming people, we are harming the cause, even in our courts and all that. It's all about punishment. What we need to do is to change our whole concept of justice. It should be more about healing people and understanding and helping them. So we can build prisons and shut people up. And, you know, I think the greatest evil that took place in modern society is our dividing the world into good people and bad people.
Yes.
And we are constantly told by politicians that we can get rid of all the bad people in the world and we will be left with all good people, which is a total lie.
Yes.
Because everybody is capable of doing good and everybody is capable of doing bad.
That's the downside of polarization. When we're polarized, yes, we lose all sense of logic. We literally lose our center and we divide people into good and bad. And that really is quite childish. And we do need to grow up and realize that we're capable of both evil, ignorance, and greatness. We have all of that inside of us.
Yes, and so I got sidetracked about Jim Lawson, but that is what Jim Lawson taught. And at the time that Jim Lawson was teaching that in Nashville, John Lewis was one of the students learning from him. And then he practiced it himself in his life.
The book that John Lewis wrote most recently is so filled with the Gandhi philosophy that love is the basis of nonviolence. Dr. King adapted it. And John Lewis was so clear that when he was sitting at that Woolworths counter, that the one thing that was most important was his spiritual teachings, the teachings that hate cannot cure hate. It's got to be love that lifts hate. And I am so impressed with the fact that James Lawson and John Lewis, Dr. King, it all came from the Gandhi understanding of the principle of love that's the basis of satyagraha and ahimsa, that is the most important thing. And it seems that their political activism came from this basis of love. What can we do to keep that idea at the forefront of our minds now?
It's a lot of education, a lot of understanding, reaching out to people. You know, all of us have a role to play in this. It's not just the government or not just a section of the people who have to do this. We all have to do this to educate each other and understand each other as best we can all the time. And so it's going to be a very long drawn out thing because we have practiced this kind of culture of violence for so many centuries that getting rid of it from our system and our understanding is going to take some time. But we have to have that commitment and that desire to make that change in ourselves. And as I said earlier, nonviolence is not a difficult thing. It's just acknowledging the fact that we should allow the goodness in us to flow, all the love and respect and understanding. And that is basically what nonviolence is. So when we find a situation that is wrong, we try to find a solution to it that is equitable to all. There's a very good story in grandfather's life. In 1913, when he was still in South Africa, he decided to launch one major campaign against prejudices and against all the oppression of the non-white people in South Africa. And as he always did, he publicized everything. Why he was going to do it, what he was going to do, where he was going to do. Everything was published in the newspaper so that everybody knew about it, from the government to the people. There was no secrecy in any of his acts. After publicizing this, the next day, the workers of the South African railways decided to go on a strike for better working conditions. And that was publicized in the newspapers. So when grandfather read that, he realized that that was going to affect the people and the government more deeply than what he was proposing to do. Because that was really going to affect the transport of people, the transport of food and things. And so, you know, that was something more urgent. So he announced the withdrawal of his campaign. He said, I'm withdrawing my campaign until this strike is over and the government is free of it, then I will launch my campaign. The workers came to grandfather and they said, we are fighting the same enemy. So why don't you join us? We can strengthen each other and we can fight the same enemy. So grandfather said to them, he said, I don't have any enemies. I'm not fighting an enemy. I'm transforming a friend. Now that is a very important thing. Look at the other person as an enemy and we want to fight that enemy. That is the culture of violence.
This is what why Dr. King uses the term opponents in his Six Principles of Nonviolent Action, is that we don't have enemies. We have opponents who think differently, but our goal is to make them friends.
Yeah. So when Gandhi said this, and he refused to join the workers, they went and they did their strike. And there was, although it was seemingly non-violent because they didn't fight or throw bricks and things at anybody, but there was a lot of anger and hate in the people. And so they were expressing a lot of anger in the slogans, down with the government and down with this, and you know what strikers do. Mm-hmm. So it was very easy for the authorities to infiltrate the ranks of these strikers and cause an incident that gave them the opportunity to use police force to crush the strike. Mm. So in 4 days, the strike was crushed and the people had to go back to work without gaining anything at all. And then after that strike was over, Grandfather launched his campaign. And there was no anger, no fist showing, no slogans. He was quietly going and protesting. And when police came to arrest them, they quietly went into the police vehicles and allowed them to be arrested and taken away. And the result of that was that within a couple of weeks, all the prisons were filled and they didn't have room for any more people there. Mm-hmm. And that is when the Prime Minister invited Grandfather to come and negotiate a settlement. And he brought him straight from the prison into his Prime Minister's office. And the Prime Minister confessed to him. He said, I could deal with the railway strikers because there was so much anger and frustration there that I could cause an incident and crush them. But he said, I don't know how to deal with you. You show so much love and understanding and respect to us that I don't know how to crush you. That is the key to a successful nonviolent action. So when I see the present protests in the streets, although they claim it is nonviolent, there is so much anger and hate. So it's very easy for somebody to infiltrate the ranks and cause all these incidents. Then we start pointing fingers that they did it and so on. But you know, we create that atmosphere for them to join us.
One of the things that John Lewis said was, do you think that we decided to march on Montgomery overnight? Do you think all of this happened? We organized, we took classes, we learned, we discussed. I mean, there was a 2-year period from the time they organized to the time that they actually did anything. And perhaps this is what needs to happen now, more organization, more understanding of the principles of nonviolence. I hear when you say it's easy, but it takes quite a lot of discipline and quite a big change of heart, quite a lot of alleviating anger and fear and making that shift precisely because of the story that you just shared, precisely because of the response we want to evoke in others, and that is of love.
Any civilized human being would act in love and respect and understanding rather than anger and frustration. So we've got to define what we mean by civilization. Mm-hmm. We are really civilized and progressive human beings. We should act in that way. And when we adopt that love and understanding, then other things follow, and you know, we begin to look at people and we begin to look at life in a different light. You know, it's very unfortunate, and I think it's part of the culture of violence that we have become so accustomed to reacting to people and reacting violently or angrily. Why can't we react with love? If somebody cuts us off on the highway, Why do we want to show them a fist and react angrily? Because that is exactly what they want. And that leads, one lead thing leads to the next. And the next thing you know is they take out their guns and shoot at each other.
I was speaking with a Black ally the other day, and I was talking to him about the principles of nonviolence. And he said, I don't know if I could allow myself to be beaten. I don't know if I could surrender to that because I would feel that at some point I would have to defend myself. I would have to hit back. He just said, I don't know if I can consider myself a peace activist because I just don't understand why other people should hit me without my striking back. How would you respond?
I think that's the whole thing about the culture of violence. Then when we strike back, we are not focused on the problem, we are focused on the individual. The individual is provoking us to strike back because either he or she is stronger than us and can beat us down, or that's the best that they know. So in the culture of nonviolence, we focus more on problem rather than the person. Whereas yes. In the culture of violence, we focus on the person more than the problem.
The moment we feel stronger about freedom and equality than we do about our own ego gratification, then we'll begin to move toward a culture of peace.
Exactly. And that's what I said, you know, our ego and our aggressiveness, this whole idea that has been pumped into us for so many generations that we are a superpower and nobody messes with us, you know. And I keep saying this, that we may be a superpower in terms of our military strength, but we need to show people that we can also be a superpower in terms of our moral strength, and that we are willing to do what is good for others and the world, and not just what is good for ourselves. Today, because of our military strength, we can look down on the rest of the world and we can tell them to go to hell or whatever and have no respect for them. That's not the kind of relationship anybody wants. Today, we have broken our relationships with many of the European countries who have been our allies because of our aggression. It's that ego and that aggressiveness that is going to destroy this country. It's not going to make it powerful. It's going to eventually destroy this country. It's only when we are able to curb that ego and that aggressiveness and realize that we are part of this whole world. And what, you know, we have another myth that is going around in all the countries, that we can build a strong army and have weapons of mass destruction and we can protect ourselves. Now, you can protect, maybe physically protect this part of the world, but if the rest of the world is going down the drain, as it is going down right now because of poverty and ignorance and lack of resources, we are going down with them. Mm. We are not going to be able to save ourselves. This pandemic has shown us. It started in one part of the world, but it's taken over the whole world. We couldn't, our strength and our army and all the progress that we have achieved so far has not been able to save us from it. So the environment and ecology and all of these things are eventually going to destroy us. Pollution from China and other Asian countries comes across the ocean into the United States. We may have the strongest environmental laws, but we can't stop that pollution from coming here and affecting our atmosphere. So this whole concept that we can have stability and security in this part of the world and forget about the rest of the world is a myth. The stability and security of any part of the world depends on the stability and security of the whole world. And it's only when we have that vision of helping the rest of the world have a better standard of living and have a better education and all of these things, that we will eventually create that peace in the world. And again, going back to the culture of violence, we have created this whole sense of exploitation. Because we are selfish and we want everything for ourselves, we are constantly exploiting other people. Individually, we are constantly exploiting one another because we want something from them. And when we stop getting something from them, we just throw them aside as though they are a piece of rag and not another human being. We do that individually, we do that nationally. Every nation in the world is exploiting every other nation in the world because of what they want. All the raw materials and things that we want from other countries, we may be buying them, but because we have the power to buy them and we know that it's only good for us, it's not good for them to sell those things, we still go and do that. Even simple things like wildlife, because we have the money and our rich people go there to hunt elephants and tigers and lions to shoot them down and pay the local governments $10,000 for each life that they take. Now, what's that? What are you doing there? How is it helping the environment? Or just giving dollars to some official there gives you the right to go and destroy your wildlife and environment?
For some, it's a badge of honor, isn't it? That's what they think of it as, a badge of honor.
That is the culture of violence. Being able to take a life and destroy things is a badge of honor. I'm so powerful. Mm-hmm. I'm so brave. Mm-hmm. What is the bravery? Go and face an elephant without any weapons and see where your bravery is.
It is said that we go from dependence to independence to interdependence. And so it would seem that this evolutionary experience, you know, as children, we're very dependent and we need to have our needs met. But it's important for us to grow into understanding that we can do things for ourselves. But it's only then that we graduate to the idea that we are not independent, we're interdependent, but we don't need each other to get what we need and throw it away, as you so aptly pointed out, but we need each other because we are each other. And because unless all are free, no one is free.
Yeah, that is that community feeling that we need to have. You know, today we think we have a community, but we basically have a neighborhood. We don't have a community. We live in the same neighborhood, but we don't know who the person next door to us is, and we don't care about them. A community is where we are all bound together, and we have a healthy relationship, and we feel each other's pain, and we share in each other's happiness. That is a community, and that we don't have anywhere.
I'd love to give you a hug right now, but I know that you can feel our love from in your heart. I know that you can feel that, and I feel so blessed to be able to have this opportunity with you. In our view of you right now is that beautiful portrait of your grandfather and grandmother. It's such a beautiful, and then your positioning is, you know, the next generation, and how powerfully and wonderfully you have been an emissary for peace throughout the world. You call yourself a peace farmer.
Yes, I do. And my grandfather always said that peacemaking is like farming. You can just go and plant seeds and hope and pray that they will get, you get a good crop from it.
Do you ever get into a place where you wonder who's listening, you know, a type of frustration or a sense of temporary hopelessness. If so, how do you deal with that?
Yes, sometimes, in moments of weaknesses, I do feel, why am I wasting time when nobody is listening to me anyway? But then I see that even if I speak to 100 people and there are 2 people or 3 people who really absorb what I'm saying, I think it's worth it.
You are absolutely right. And what an incredible inspiration that is. It's just too easy to go to that place, which is, it is a dark place and a place off to the side rather than in our center where we say, who am I talking to? Who cares? You know, I'm wasting my time or I'm not good enough to deliver the message. And yet that is something that we need to actually work together on helping and supporting each other and reminding each other, as you say, that even if one person gets it, the range that person has to share it with someone else and share it with someone else, that's really what it's all about. And I can only say that you continue to be a most amazing inspiration. You go wherever you're asked to go and speak, don't you?
I do.
Yeah. And you don't say, no, it's too small a crowd, or no, it's too far away. You go all around the world and share that truth. Let me ask you about the Gandhi Legacy Tours. Are you still doing those?
Well, I did one last December, but now with this pandemic,
of course,
I don't know whether I certainly won't be able to take any people this year. And whether people will be ready to travel again next year or the year after, I don't know. And now age is catching up. I'm 87. I don't know how long I can continue to do that. So it's all in a flux at the moment. And perhaps my son or somebody will take it up and do it there in India. But the thing is, somebody has to be here to mobilize people and to motivate them to go.
Maybe you can get a videographer to actually film the Legacy Tour and make that available to people.
I've did that for 20 years. And for 19 of them, I've had videographers come and record the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
And I haven't seen the daylight of any one of them yet.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Right from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation to CNN to individuals, not one of them has materialized. Mm. And I realize the problem there is, the problem is that it's easy to go and shoot films or videos of all the whole tour, but editing it is the crucial part, and that's time consuming and money consuming.
Exactly.
And that's where everybody gets stuck. They have boxes full of videos of the whole tour, but putting them together and editing them, they can't find the time for it, and that's why I've not seen anything work.
It's possible. The time has come. We are so inundated with wake-up calls that we just have to wake up, don't we?
Right now, there's a friend in San Antonio who came on the tour last year and with a whole team of cameramen and sound men and recorded the whole thing. Now, she is trying to edit the thing and put it together. And is looking for funds to help her do it. And every time she gets a little bit, she takes another step forward. So in any way you can find funds for it and help them, then we might see the daylight of at least one film.
I would like to share with our listeners that the Gandhi Legacy Tour is an incredibly inspiring opportunity to visit the places that Gandhi spoke his truth, and the history that goes along with it is a fascinating tour. Arun and his son Tushar have been going on that tour, as he said, for the last 20 years. It's something that can be used in an educational setting. It's something that can be used for private groups, not-for-profit groups, all kinds of groups, but particularly educating children, educating adults, and going into any nonviolence group, a tremendous asset. And so I'm really very happy to hear about this and how we can support it. Matthew, any parting words that you'd like to share with Arun?
I just want to say thanks so much for all that you give to everyone. I think it's so interesting. You learned from Gandhi, from your grandfather, and now you yourself are a grandfather teaching all of us. It's such an amazing tradition that you're continuing, and I'm just so appreciative that you've given so much time and attention and love to us, and it's just been great getting to see you and hear your wisdom again.
Thank you.
The producer of the film about the Gandhi Legacy Tour is named Marty Noonmaker. Her website is guidedbygandhi.com, which is linked in our podcast description. On the website, you can watch the beautiful trailer for the film and press a button to make your tax-deductible donation. It looks like a really incredible project that will make such a difference in the world. Thanks so much for listening to the Get Off Your Affirmation podcast. Please follow us on Facebook and subscribe to our podcast on our website so you can be notified whenever we release new episodes.
Have a wonderful week. You deserve it.